To read Helen MacDonald's new memoir is to have every cell of your body awake and alive. You watch the words go by like, well, like a hawk. H is for Hawk tells of how, after her beloved father suddenly dies, Helen decides to raise and train one of the most vicious birds of prey, the goshawk. Helen is a falconer. She's hawked before, and we readers learn what that is. She's also an historian, a naturalist, a research scholar at the University of Cambridge in England. But when she first meets the bird she'd heard described as a spooky, pale-eyed psychopath, even she thinks, what have I done?
The goshawk is staring at me in mortal terror, and I can feel the silences between both our heartbeats coincide. Her eyes are luminous, silver in the gloom. Her beak is open. She breathes hot hawk breath in my face. It smells of pepper and musk and burnt stone. Her feathers are half raised and her wings half open, and her scaled yellow toes and curved black talons grip the glove tightly. It feels like I'm holding a flaming torch.
She names her goshawk Mabel, and later when she takes Mabel hunting, she feels like she's holding the bastard offspring of a flaming torch and an assault rifle. But wait, Mabel is also playful, a calm companion. None of the hawking books, including one of the most famous by T.H. White, yes, author of The Sword and the Stone, none mention that. So Helen's book includes a riveting parallel story about T.H. White. The New York Times calls it beautiful and nearly feral. And Helen MacDonald joins us from the BBC studios. Welcome.
Thank you. It's lovely to be speaking with you.
Well, I'm thinking those two words, beautiful and nearly feral, describe you at certain points in this book as well.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I just became this very, very strange creature, you know. I used to get up in the morning, have a cup of coffee, then just pick the hawk out of off her perch and go off into the wild. And I'd watch her fly for hours on end, and I'd get covered in mud and thorn scratches. And yeah, I became this very different beast.
We'll talk about how you get here. You had one of those childhoods that we in America sometimes think only happens on Masterpiece Theater, wandering fields with binoculars, collecting reindeer moss. What was it about birds?
I honestly don't know. I mean, I loved birds when I was so young that I can't put a finger on when it started. I used to dream about them at night. I used to draw them compulsively. And you know, my parents put up with me. I don't know how they did it. I was this strange, obsessed child that used to constantly talk about, particularly birds of prey. I thought they were the most beautiful things that the world had ever made.
And the family was already not putting up with, but adoring a father, husband who was a photographer, a newspaper photographer. And as you write your memoir, you realize how connected it is to be a photographer and to be someone who stands and watches things like birds.
Absolutely. And I think I learned really how to see the world from my father. He was a very, very great press photographer, and he really taught me how that the world was full of extraordinary, beautiful happenings, and that your job was to kind of be there and witness them.
When he dies, you really have one of the best descriptions I've ever seen of feeling that sudden loss. If I may, I remember when my father died way too young, when an ambulance went by, I stood still and said to myself, oh, they're coming to get me, because they must see that how I'm feeling is somehow showing on the outside. And I literally stood there.
Absolutely.
Describe how broken you felt.
Yeah. In the first sort of week or so, it felt like I was made of dully burning metal, you know, sort of red hot. And if you put me on a sofa or a chair or a bed, I'd just burn right through. Mm. You know, when you told me that story there about the ambulances, I remember, you know, hearing ambulances after my father died. And all I could think of was that, you know, that obviously one had gone to him and it had not managed to save him. And I just stand there with tears in my eyes, you know, hot tears. I mean, it's a very, very hard time.
Well, so you become a perfect companion for a hawk at that point. Now, let's just talk a little bit what this is. Literally training a bird to sit on your fist. And the goal is that someday you're going to let that bird go and hope it comes back.
The American writer Stephen Bodio describes it as learning how to be polite to a bird. It's not a cruel relationship. It's not one of subjection and kind of power. It's really a very extraordinary close relationship in which, you know, your goal is to get the hawk to accept you as kind of a companion and then go out and watch the hawk do what it would do naturally in the wild, which is fly and soar and hunt. For many, many millennia, there have been people like me sitting in darkened rooms, willing hawks to lean down and take that first bite of raw meat from your gloved fist, you know, the first step on that long journey.
And then once they associate you with someone who can care for them and provide food and a home, you then let them go where they do what they do, which is hunt. And what's fascinating is, here you are, a person who hadn't thought about death as acutely before your father's death, and now you're realizing you're complicit with a natural killer.
Yeah, I mean, it's the great irony, I suppose, that there I was running from death as fast as I could and sort of flying with the hawk to try and escape it. And of course, these hawks are natural killers, and I had to, be with the hawk while she hunted. And of course, you know, hawks aren't particularly kind creatures. You know, when they catch birds or animals, they just start eating. And at some point, you know, the poor animal is going to expire. And I had to run in and you know, humanely put these poor things out of their misery. Mm. And that was a very, very intense and extraordinary and very, I guess, humbling experience to realize we don't see death anymore. It's not something that many people really have any contact with. And it was very educational in the deepest possible sense.
That's Helen MacDonald. Her new piercingly wonderful memoir is called H is for Hawk. And Helen, you'd gotten to the point in the book when, after weeks and weeks of training, you are flying her. What's it called? There's a word for it. Is it hawking? What is?
Yeah, hawking. You go hawking with a bird of prey. So, yeah, initially you train them on a long line called the creance, and then you take the creance away. And the only thing that keeps the hawk with you, really, are those bonds of trust and love that you sort of forged over the few weeks that you've been with the bird. And it's always a very intense time when you fly a hawk free.
Can you describe a little more what it's like to see this bird that could also play catch with crumpled up paper with you in your apartment? What's that like to see a goshawk?
When I used to watch Mabel fly, quite often it would be as if she was flying at the right speed and everything else that was happening around slowed right down. You know, like everything, rabbits were running. It's almost as if they were sort of running through liquid. It had extraordinary effects on the sort of way that the world appeared to me. And then those moments when, you know, the bird would go out of sight and I'd suddenly get panicked and think, you know, where is she? And
you'd get panicked.
Yeah.
I was reading, my stomach was, you know, flip-flopping. You have to trust that she'll come back.
You do. And I think, you know, deep down, that's part of the reason that I flew to the hawk at that point. You know, I'd suffered this great loss. My father and I were very, very good friends, as well as him being a very dear father. And falconry, I guess, it's about that sense of things going away and then things coming back again. And every time the hawk flew back, it somehow kind of, it tied me to the world again. It was like, you know, nothing was completely lost. It was a very strong emotional kind of movement.
Well, but there's a point where you realize you've become lost. You've crossed over too much into hawk territory. You eventually go to a doctor. He prescribes antidepressants. And you slowly give Mabel her own world, separate yourself from it?
Yes. I guess I'd spent so much time with that hawk and I'd avoided everyone. I'd kind of, you know, barricaded my door against the world and I just wanted to be a hawk, you know. And I say in the book that they're kind of solitary and self-possessed. They don't suffer grief, you know, and I just wanted to be that thing. And I guess I realized after going to the doctors, which was a kind of grimly funny experience, actually, particularly the question he asked me on this questionnaire is, you know, did I take less care over my appearance than previously? And there I was in this thorn-ripped trousers, you know, covered in rabbit blood. But I guess I realized that I'd made this great mistake, and I'd run too far into the wild. I tried to heal myself through going into the wild, and actually the hawk wasn't me. The hawk was to be treasured because she was so different from me. She was utterly herself and utterly wild. And once I realized that, things became a little bit less pointed, a little bit less hard to bear.
We only have a little time here, but she was also so much different than you'd been told. And there's a scene where you go back over all these esteemed hawking books, and you conclude, and a little bit about T.H. White here, these men, largely men, missed something about having a hawk as a companion.
Yeah, it's really kind of grimly funny that a lot of the Victorian 19th century books talked about goshawks in ways that made them seem very much like kind of hysterical women, you know. If they sat up trees or flew away, it was never your fault, you know. It was always them. And then I discovered, yes, that I could play with Mabel, you know, and she used to play like a kitten. And I remember talking to some goshawk friends of mine, and they were all horrified, all these boys. They said, you know, you don't play with goshawks. You know, you just don't. But recently I've discovered that they all do. They just don't let on about it. So I think that says something about kind of masculine culture rather than the hawks themselves.
Just a thought on poor T.H. White, who got a goshawk, what, perhaps hoping that he could erase his own relationship with his father, interestingly, and yet he only repeated it in a way. His father was abusive, and he was somewhat abusive to his hawk.
Yeah, it's a terribly, terribly tragic story in a beautiful book, The Goshawk, that he wrote about this experience. He was trying to tame himself or to conquer himself through conquering this bird. And I think that's the lesson of the book, maybe, if there is one, is that we so routinely use nature as a mirror of our own needs. And both White and I did that with our hawks initially. And luckily my hawk, you know, I kind of realized my mistake, and Mabel and I, you know, had a very healthy life compared to Goss and White. But it's a real lesson. And I think that's one of the reasons I called the book H is for Hawk. It's like a kind of child's book. It's how to learn how to look at the world.
Well, that's remarkable. Helen MacDonald, the book again about training Mabel the goshawk is H is for Hawk. Helen MacDonald, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.